What's up, you guys? I'm Haley.
And I'm Andrea.
And this is Inhuman, a true crime podcast. Nighttime edition. We are
delirious.
Well, out of it, a little delirious, but
we're here.
Welcome back. Today I am kind of continuing on with my spooky, not really spooky, but like kind of Halloween spooky season, quote unquote, theme.
Okay.
Because we are going to talk about the murderer who somewhat inspired the slasher film Scream.
Which, if you have not seen, is a classic. So get your butt out there and watch it. At least the first one.
I will not be watching it.
It's not that scary. I mean, yeah, it's pretty scary.
Yeah, no. I'm good. But apparently it's a good movie if you like those types of movies. I'm sure if you like those types of movies, you've probably seen it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I did not know that this movie was inspired by an actual murder. And I actually heard about it on TikTok. And I looked up the case and realized it was so much deeper than just like one murder. And so I wanted to share the victim story today because I feel like, you know, you hear, oh, it's inspired by a murder. And then sometimes you hear that it's inspired by this man, but you don't hear the victim's names as often.
It gets outshadowed. No.
Overshadowed.
Overshadowed. Yep. That's it.
Yeah. So I wanted to share this story. So this is the story of the Gainesville Ripper, Danny Rowling, and the murders of Sonia Larson, Christina Powell, Krista Hoyt, Manny Tabota, Tracy Paulus, and Tom, Julie, and Sean Grissom.
Oh my gosh. That's so many people. And what Gainesville is this in? Like what state?
Florida.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Oof.
Yeah. So let's get into it. In 1994, novice screenwriter Kevin Williamson was house-sitting for a friend when he turned on a show called Turning Point, which was a news program on ABC in the 90s. And the episode he turned on was about a serial killer named Danny Rowling. And he became unsettled after watching the program. And then a little while later, he noticed that a window in the house he was house-sitting at was open.
Oh, no.
He became even more apprehensive, so he grabbed a knife and called a friend to come over so he wouldn't be alone. When the friend arrived, they began talking about horror characters like Freddy Krueger and Jason Voorhees that they were, you know, interested in. They liked horror movies.
Yeah.
And between that, watching the show about the serial killer and being alone in the house, Williamson had a nightmare that night about a home invasion. And he took that as inspiration to write a new screenplay.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I know. At the time, he was a new screenwriter. He was struggling financially. So he was looking for his big break. And this was it.
Boy, did he get it.
Yeah. He spent the next 3 days listening to the score from the movie Halloween for even more inspiration. And he wrote a script for a slasher film that at the time he called Scary Movie. Which I think is funny that he called that because, like, Scary Movie
is the spoof
of that.
Is now,
like, a parody. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's funny.
That is funny. I never knew that.
Yeah. But this script was inspired by his experience of fear about a home invasion. It was also inspired by a one-act play he wrote in college about an anonymous caller taunting a young girl. And then he also took inspiration from several of his favorite horror films.
Oh, that's interesting.
He later said, quote, he developed much of the script around a single line of dialogue. Movies don't create psychos. Movies make psychos more creative.
Hmm.
Yeah. Really creepy.
Yeah.
Kevin Williamson used serial killer Daniel Rowling's crimes as inspiration for Scream, which, as Andrea said, is a classic.
Mm-hmm.
So let's dive into who Danny Rowling is and his victims. If you want to hear where'd you get that this holiday season, Uncommon Goods is your secret weapon. Uncommon Goods is here to make your holiday shopping stress-free by scouring the globe for the most unique and truly remarkable gifts for everyone on your list. Whether you're shopping for your white elephant party or your special someone, Uncommon Goods knows exactly what they want and need.
I was so excited and intrigued to see that they even have gifts for kiddos. I've been eyeballing their Create Your Own video game set, which I know my five-year-old son would love.
Oh my gosh.
And for the twins, I found this exceptionally neat Mix Your Own finger paint set that's so cool. They would have so much fun with. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. These fine products are often made in small batches, so shop now before they sell out this holiday season.
And the best part is, with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. Aww. They've donated more than $2.5 million to date.
Wow.
Uncommon Goods is the perfect place to get unique, thoughtful gifts this holiday season. So head over to uncommongoods.com/inhuman to get 15% off your next gift.
That's uncommongoods.com/inhuman for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
Daniel Harold Rowling was born on May 26, 1954 in Shreveport, Louisiana, to James and Claudia Rowling. His father, who was a police officer in Shreveport, told Danny from a very young age that he was unwanted.
What?
Yeah.
Why? That...
His father was a terrible person. He started physically abusing Danny as young as when Danny was starting to crawl.
Why have a kid? Why?
I know. James also physically abused his wife and his other son, and it was always for ridiculous things like breathing in a way he didn't like.
Get the fuck out of here.
Claudia repeatedly tried to leave her husband, but she always ended up returning.
I hate that.
I know, and I feel like that's all too common. It's really hard to get out.
Yep.
Danny's childhood was filled with very aggressive discipline. He was beaten, handcuffed, pinned to the ground, as just a few examples. Danny failed the third grade for too many absences due to illness, and it's unclear if that was actual illness or just him missing school.
Right.
But this led his mother to have a nervous breakdown, and when school counselors... evaluated him, they described the then 9-year-old as, quote, suffering from an inferiority complex with aggressive tendencies and poor impulse control.
That sounds like ODD. I think that's what it's called.
It kind of does, yeah.
Before they knew what ODD
was. Yeah. And just a trigger warning for mention of suicide in the next part, so skip ahead if you need. At age 11, Claudia, Danny's mother, was committed to the hospital after she slit her wrists, and she later claimed that her husband gave her a razor and forced her to do so.
Oh my God. Why didn't he just leave?
I know. Just leave your wife and kids alone.
Yeah.
He probably wanted to have control over them. That was his way of having control.
Yeah.
At this point, to cope with all that was going on in his life, Danny started using drugs and drinking alcohol.
Oh, that poor baby.
I know. And again, like we always say, feel bad for the kid, not the adult. This guy turned into a horrible
monster,
person. And there are plenty of people who experience horrible things as a child that don't turn into this. But it is hard to not feel bad for the child version of him.
Yeah, you do. You have to. I mean, if you have any kind of compassion or heart, they're just innocent children.
I know. As a teenager, Danny was arrested several times for robbery, and at 14 years old, he was caught spying on a neighbor's daughter through her window.
Oh, geez.
As an adult, Danny wasn't able to hold down a steady job or get along well with others, so he decided to enlist in the military, but apparently the Navy wouldn't take him. I can't find why the Navy wouldn't take him.
Probably because they did a psych eval on him, and they were no.
Yeah. But he ended up joining the Air Force, and he eventually was kicked out after getting caught for drug use. It's reported that during his time in the Air Force, he took acid more than 100 times. On top of the nature and nurture of his, what led him to be a killer, that's got to be really
bad. That on its own is... I mean, detrimental to your brain.
Yeah.
You know, that many times, I think. Yeah, I really absolutely believe that.
After he was discharged from the Air Force, Danny actually got married and had a daughter.
Bless.
But he was only with his wife for 4 years when, in 1977, she left him after he threatened to kill her. He was only 23 years old.
Following in his father's footsteps.
Mm-hmm. After this, he was devastated and angry, and Danny committed sexual assault of a woman who looked exactly like his ex-wife. But he was never arrested for this.
What?
In late 1977, Danny ended up killing a woman in a car accident. And this was deemed an accident, but it's just like things just keep piling on to him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, was he at fault? Like, do we know?
I don't know, because he was never like charged with anything. Okay. So, and it was, you know, an accident. So if it was anything, it would have been like vehicular manslaughter, I think. But he didn't get charged with anything.
Okay.
From this point until late 1989, Danny committed several petty crimes and thefts, and he was arrested and then released several times in Louisiana, Mississippi, Georgia, and Alabama. But by 1991, he would be arrested for murder.
Mm-hmm.
So in May 1990, things really escalated. Danny got into an argument with his 58-year-old father and ended up shooting him.
Oh.
James survived, but he ended up losing an eye and an ear because of the shooting.
Oh my God.
Wow. And after this, Danny fled Shreveport, changed his identity with documents he had stolen from someone's house, and he took up life in Sarasota, Florida. By July 1990, he was living at a campsite in Florida as Michael Kennedy Jr., and his crimes were about to elevate.
Yeah, he got a little taste of that. I mean, karma for his dad, but, you know.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can't believe he survived a gunshot.
I know.
In the head. That's wild.
I know. It's crazy. I think he was shot in the stomach and then the head, and he lost an eye and an ear, but he survived.
That's crazy.
In August 1990, 36-year-old Danny Rowling took the lives of 5 students from Santa Fe College at the University and the University of Florida during what was later called a 4-day spree in Gainesville, Florida. This all began on Friday, August 24th, 1990, just 2 days before classes for the fall semester were set to begin.
Wow.
In the early morning hours of that Friday, Danny Rowling broke into an apartment shared by 2 freshmen at the University of Florida, 18-year-old Sonia Larson and 17-year-old Christina Powell. He used a screwdriver to break the door jamb on their back door. Christina was asleep on the couch downstairs, and Danny briefly stood over her but didn't wake her up, and instead headed to the stairs, to the upstairs bedroom where Sonia was also asleep. He briefly woke her up before taping her mouth shut to stifle her screams.
Oh my God.
He then stabbed her to death. She had defensive wounds, so she had tried everything she could to fight him off. After murdering Sonia, Rowling went back downstairs, taped Christina's mouth shut so she couldn't scream. He bound her wrists behind her back and threatened her with the knife he had as he cut off her clothes. He then raped her and forced her to lie face down on the floor and stabbed her 5 times in the back, killing her.
Oh my God. That is brutal.
Yeah. If you want to skip ahead, this gets a little bit graphic, so skip ahead like 60 seconds if you don't want to hear this next part.
I think I know this next part.
Yeah. After murdering both women, Rowling posed their bodies in a sexually provocative way. He mutilated them, including cutting off their nipples and keeping one as a trophy.
Yeah.
He then cleaned their bodies and then, likely to get rid of DNA. Then he showered at the apartment before leaving.
That's interesting. That's risky.
Yeah. Ada Larson, Sonia's mom, said that they became worried when they couldn't reach their daughter a few days after she had moved into her apartment. Gosh. She had actually been upset that Sonia was living in an off-campus apartment, but all the dorms were full.
No.
After not being able to reach Sonia, the Larsons contacted her roommate's family, and the Powells also hadn't heard from their daughter, and they lived closer to campus, so they went over to check on the girls.
Oh my God.
On August 26th, Christina's parents knocked on the apartment door, but the girls didn't answer, so they asked a maintenance worker at the complex for help.
No.
The maintenance worker, apartment complex manager, and a police officer headed to the apartment and broke down the door. And when they did, they found a horrific scene.
Well, that's good that they had, like, the thought capacity to have all those people there to kind of buffer.
Yeah, the maintenance worker went to the manager, and then the manager was like, let's get a police officer.
Yeah.
So they were there, but Christina's parents were right behind them.
Yeah.
When they opened the door. Apparently, after opening the door and seeing the scene, the maintenance worker ran out of the apartment screaming, oh my God, and then ran down the stairs and threw up.
Oh my goodness.
The same day that Christina and Sonia were discovered, Rolling struck again.
Damn.
Yeah. He broke into an apartment at nearby Santa Fe College by prying open the sliding glass door with a screwdriver. This apartment belonged to 18-year-old student Krista Hoyt, but she wasn't home, so he waited in her living room for her to return. She returned around 11 a.m., and when she went into the apartment, Rolling attacked her from behind, placing her in a chokehold. He then used duct tape to stifle her screams and bind her wrists together. He led her into the bedroom, where he cut her clothes from her body and raped her. Then, like with Christina, he forced her to lie face down on the bed and stabbed her in the back. And again, this next part is also very graphic, so skip ahead if you don't want to hear this next part. After murdering Krista, Rolling sliced her abdomen open from her pubic bone to her breastbone.
Oh my God.
He then removed her nipples and placed them beside her.
What the fuck?
Then he left the crime scene, but when he got back to the campsite he was living at, Rolling couldn't find his wallet. He believed he had left it at Krista's apartment, so he returned. And when he went back, he decapitated her.
What?
Posed her body in a sitting position at the end of her bed, and then placed her head on a shelf facing the corpse.
That is beyond disgusting.
Yeah. He would later say that his intention was to shock whoever discovered her. The next day, Krista failed to show up for work. So she was actually an aspiring police officer. And while studying, she had been working part-time at the sheriff's office. And when she didn't show up for work, Officer Gail Barber and another officer were dispatched to her home to check on her.
Interesting, because Gail is one of the characters in the movie.
Oh, interesting. Like
Courtney Cox's character, I believe.
Oh. When Barber arrived at Krista's home, she found the horrific scene.
Hmm.
2 days later, Rolling struck for a third time.
Wow, he is really ballsy.
Yeah. On Monday, August 27th, Rolling broke into another apartment the same way, prying open the sliding glass door with a screwdriver. This apartment at the University of Florida belonged to Tracy Paulus and Manuel Tabota, both 23 years old. Rolling found Manny asleep in one of the bedrooms, and after a struggle, he murdered him. Hearing the commotion, Tracy went down the hall to Manny's room to see what was going on, and that's when she spotted Rolling, so she sprinted back to her room where she attempted to barricade herself in.
Oh my goodness.
Unfortunately, Rolling was able to break through the door. He then taped her mouth and wrists, cut off her clothing, and raped her before turning her over and stabbing her 3 times in the back.
What a coward. He can't even face his victims.
I was thinking the same thing when I was doing this research. Every person other than Manny that he murdered, he stabbed them in the back.
Yeah.
He then posed Tracy's body and left the crime scene. And interestingly, he left Manny's body as it was when he died. And it almost seems as if Manny was a victim of opportunity,
yeah,
kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time and not an intentional victim.
Well, he doesn't fit the mm-hmm. MO because he's a male. So
exactly.
He probably was just like, well, you're going to get killed too because you're just here.
Yeah. And going off of that, the three female victims all looked very similar. They were petite white women with brown hair and brown eyes. And this was just like Rowling's mother, Claudia.
That's interesting. So was he like stalking them or like
very possibly
was it called like not scouting them?
Oh my gosh, what's the word?
It's like right there. Tip of my tongue.
What is that word? I have no clue. I cannot think of that
Someone's screaming it at us right now.
I know. We're going to get a million messages like, this is the word. So please send us that if you know the word.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't freaking
think
of it either.
He must have been doing that word.
Yes. Yes.
Because like how, I mean, what are the odds that he would, they would all look the same or similar?
Yeah. No, he definitely was. Manny had dreams of being an architect. Tracy wanted to become a lawyer.
I don't know about you guys, but sometimes I just want to veg out on my phone and play a fun game. Recently, I discovered June's Journey, which is a hidden object mystery game, and I am obsessed. I am 3 chapters in, and I cannot put it down.
I've been loving it too, because not only does it bring out my inner detective, but eventually I'll be able to uncover the mystery behind the case. You play the game as June Parker, a young woman in the 1920s trying to solve her own sister's murder. And the clues that you start finding all point to June's family having some deep, dark secrets.
During the game, you get to create your own estate, which appeals to my inner interior designer. But before we ruin too much for you guys, you have to download June's Journey for yourself. It's free today on iOS and Android devices.
Check out the link to download June's Journey in the show notes of this episode. By this point, reports of the murders had spread nationwide. Like I said, it was early on in the fall semester, so some students actually withdrew their enrollment or transferred to other schools.
Wow, yeah.
I would have been out of there so fast.
Yeah, fuck that. No.
Other students changed their daily routines. They slept together in groups taking shifts, so somebody was always awake. Students would walk around with baseball bats, and no one went out alone at any time during the day or night.
That must have been so scary for that area.
I know.
Can you imagine? Especially like, what if you were an out of state or out of town student and you're like,
and you're just there.
God.
Like, what did I do?
Yeah. Like,
yeah.
Jeez.
The university also increased security measures by upgrading security systems and providing services for people to be escorted. And police by this point knew that they had a serial killer on their hands, and they had one goal: to stop him before he could strike again.
And they better act fast, because this motherfucker does not wait.
No. This serial killer was being called the Gainesville Ripper. Now, there was not a lot of evidence left at the crime scenes. Rowling disposed of the duct tape used to bind his victims, so they only knew that there was duct tape used because of residue from the tape.
Yeah.
And this was to not leave fingerprints behind. And he also cleaned the bodies with vinegar to remove any DNA. Investigators actually had 2 initial suspects. One has never been named and was eventually cleared. And the other was a University of Florida freshman named Edward Lewis Humphrey. So Humphrey had a history of mental illness, and he had briefly lived in the same apartment complex as one of the crime scenes. Neighbors reported seeing Humphrey wandering the streets carrying knives, and when investigators searched his home, they found magazines about, quote, knives, guns, and girls. Humphrey was arrested just a couple of days after the murders, after a physical altercation he had with his grandmother, and he was taken into custody, charged with murder. I know. But he was taken into custody after that, and he was then charged with murder and held on a $1 million bond.
Wow.
An investigator later said, quote, "We had a lot of physical evidence that, according to our technology at the time, placed Ed Humphrey at some of the scenes. Some fiber, some hairs. They couldn't say definitively it was Ed's hair, but they couldn't say it wasn't."
Damn. What are the odds of that?
I know. And Humphrey actually was held for 5 months while police were working to get a grand jury murder indictment against him. But the grand jury refused to indict him, citing insufficient evidence.
Well, that's good. I mean, it sounds like he's a shit person, probably, maybe.
Not really. He didn't have any
criminal record.
No, he just had a history of mental illness, but not a criminal record.
Okay, my bad.
But while this was happening, they were trying to get this grand jury indictment. His photo was shown in media outlets as a viable suspect in these murders. And many people believed that he was the killer.
I hate when they do that. And then they
keep
the actual killer close to the chest and don't.
I know. Well, and at the time, they actually really thought he was the killer. Like they were all in. And he actually wasn't cleared until after Rowling's arrest.
Damn. Poor guy.
I know. Eventually, after Rowling's arrest, testing found that blood found at the crime scenes was not the same blood type as Humphrey.
Okay.
While Ed Humphrey was eventually fully exonerated, the time he spent as a suspect still affected him.
Yeah.
According to the Orlando Sentinel, he graduated from the University of Central Florida 10 years later in 2000. His lawyer said, quote, "Ed does blame himself to some degree for not taking his medicine back then. He was completely incoherent. But believe me, Ed takes his medicine as faithfully as anyone who is bipolar manic depressive in the country today."
Mm-hmm.
So the news of the deaths of Sonia, Christina, Krista, and Manny and Tracy began to get more and more media attention. And at this point, authorities in Louisiana noticed similarities between those murders and an unsolved triple homicide that had occurred in Shreveport almost a year earlier. On November 4th, 1989, 55-year-old Tom Grissom, his 24-year-old daughter Julie, and her 8-year-old son Sean had been attacked in their home as they were preparing dinner. After the attack, Julie's body had been mutilated and posed. It was later discovered that Rowling had committed these murders after being fired from his job at a restaurant, and it is believed that Julie was the target.
Mm-mm. Did she look like similar to the other victims?
Yeah. There were several similarities between the murders in Louisiana and Florida, including the way the victims were mutilated and posed, the tape residue on the victim's body, and the use of vinegar to clean the bodies.
Mm.
In November 1990, a year after the Shreveport murders and just a couple months after the Gainesville murders, an investigator on the case in Florida, Don Maines, traveled to Shreveport to talk to detectives there. And shortly after this trip, a tip came in that would break the cases wide open. Cindy Jurisich, a resident of Shreveport, called Crime Stoppers to report that Danny Rowling may be connected to the murders in both Louisiana and Florida.
Oh.
So Cindy had heard about the murders in Florida, and it made her think about Rowling, who she had met at church in Shreveport. And she ended up interacting with him a good amount. And she said that he reportedly, he said very disturbing things to both her and her then husband, Stephen Dobbin. Cindy said, quote, "He'd come over every night for a while. And then one night, Stephen came in and he goes, 'He's got to go.'"
What?
She also said that Stephen told her Rowling had told him he had a problem. Cindy said, quote, "I said, 'What kind of problem?' And Stephen said, 'He likes to stick knives into people.'"
What? He just offered that up? Yep. Like nonchalantly, like, this is this thing I do. And what did he think that they were going to say?
I know.
Like, I want to join in?
Yeah, like, I know.
Weird.
Rowling had also told Cindy, quote, "One day I'm going to leave this town and I'm going to go where the girls are beautiful and I can just lay in the sun and watch beautiful women all day."
Mm. No.
So at the time, Cindy dismissed the comments and refused to believe that Rowling could be responsible for the triple homicide in Shreveport, even though she had an inkling. She was trying to not believe it, which I don't blame her. This guy who's in your home, who is
goes interacting to church with you.
Yeah, like you don't want to believe it. You're like, oh no, it's just a coincidence. Like, how many times have we seen something where like it's just a coincidence and it might have not been?
Yeah.
But once she heard about the murders in Florida, she once again thought of Rowling. And then Don Maines visited Shreveport, and this was, you know, in the news that this detective was coming to visit, and that's when she finally contacted Crime Stoppers. She said, quote, "It would not let me rest. One day I picked up the phone, I called Crime Stoppers, and I said, I think there's one guy y'all need to investigate, Danny Rowling."
Well, that's good, at least that she listened to her gut, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, she cracked the case wide open.
Yeah. It's a shot in the dark, but it was a bullseye.
Yeah, exactly. When investigators started looking for Rowling, he was easy to find because he had been arrested on September 7th, 1990, just days after the murder of Manny and Tracy, for a robbery at a Winn-Dixie supermarket.
Right there in the area.
Yep. In Ocala, Florida. So he was being held at Marion County Jail, which was about 40 miles away from Gainesville. And upon receiving the tip, investigators immediately started looking into him. They found that Rowling had multiple convictions for armed robbery, so this led them to believe that he may have been responsible for the bank robbery that occurred on the same day that Krista Hoyt was murdered. Investigators looking into the bank robbery had tracked the robber into the woods, and they found a campsite. And at that campsite, they found a bag of money with the red dye pack that the bank teller had slipped in during the robbery. So they knew that whoever was at that campsite was responsible for the robbery.
Oh, wow.
And at that campsite, they also found a cassette tape and a screwdriver, but this wouldn't be connected until later. The cassette tape wasn't listened to right away, but after Rowling,
why?
Yeah, I don't know.
Confession tape. Like, my name is whatever.
It basically was, and the investigators basically said it just slipped away from them. You know, they at that point they hadn't connected the robbery to the murders, so they just said, you know, this is like a cassette tape. Like, they'll get to it eventually, type of thing, because it's a robbery, not a murder case.
Yeah.
But when they listened to the tape, they found audio diaries that Rowling had made alluding to the crimes. In these diaries, he not only talked about the crimes, but he said his name, Danny Harold Rowling. Because remember, he was going by that fake name after escaping Shreveport after shooting his father.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Finally, investigators found that Rowling had type B blood, which was the same blood type as the unknown suspect in both the Shreveport murders and the Gainesville murders. So by this point, investigators knew they had their guy. On November 15th, 1991, over a year after the Gainesville murders and 2 years after the Shreveport murders, Danny Rowling was arrested and charged with 5 counts of murder.
Wow.
Initially, he pleaded not guilty, and his trial would not begin for another 3 years.
What?
Before he went to trial for the murders, Rowling was convicted on federal bank robbery charges, and when he was sent to a Florida state prison for those charges while, you know, waiting the trial, he met an inmate named Bobby Lewis, and he began confessing to Bobby. Lewis later claimed that Rowling told him details of the murders and that Rowling wanted to confess. And Lewis ended up writing a 5-page letter about what Rowling had told him, and many of the details were ones only the killer would know. Investigators wanted to confirm this confession, so they arranged a meeting with Rowling, but Rowling insisted that Bobby Lewis be present and basically speak for him. So Rowling had Lewis answer the questions for him, and basically Lewis would tell investigators what Rowling told him, and then investigators would ask Rowling, is this correct? And Rowling would confirm, and his participation in this confession was on tape. Okay. So even though he wasn't directly confessing, it was almost as good as a direct confession.
Because they had him confirm, so that's like...
Exactly.
Him confessing.
Yeah. One very creepy detail that they learned from this confession was that it seemed like Tracy was aware of what was about to happen to her before she was murdered. When Rowling broke into the room that she tried to barricade herself into, quote, Tracy asked him, "You're the one, aren't you?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm the one."
Aww.
Isn't that terrifying?
That would
like
be,
she had heard about the murder. She knew what was going on. And, oh. So Rowling's trial was set to begin on February 15th, 1994. So it took several years to go to trial. And right before it began, he unexpectedly pleaded guilty to all charges. He addressed the court saying, quote, "Your Honor, I've been running from first one thing and then another all of my life. But there are some things that you just can't run from, and this being one of those."
Hmm. Interesting.
He claimed his motive was to, quote, "become a superstar like Ted Bundy."
You should never aspire to be Ted Bundy or any of those people.
No. Disgusting. After he admitted to the murders, Rowling was facing the death penalty. At his sentencing trial, the defense argued that he had believed he had an alternate personality named Gemini, and that's who was responsible for the murders.
Bull.
Yeah.
Calling bull.
The defense's tactics didn't work, and on April 20th, 1994, Danny Rowling was sentenced to death. Rowling was diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, and paraphilia.
Mm.
During his sentencing trial, Court TV interviewed Rowling's mother, Claudia, who actually testified for Danny at the trial. But during this interview, his father, James, could be heard shouting off camera.
What?
Shortly before his execution date, Danny Rowling confessed to the Grissom triple homicide in Shreveport because they hadn't, like, officially connected him to that.
Right.
So he handed a handwritten confession and apology letter to his spiritual advisor and to Florida police. Rowling's last meal was lobster tail, butterfly shrimp, a baked potato, strawberry cheesecake, and sweet tea.
Wow, that sounds amazing.
I hate that they
I know, like, why do you get that? Yeah, like, you should eat the worst thing you could think of.
Yeah. Before his execution, Rowling sang a gospel hymn but made no actual statement. His execution was witnessed by 47 people, more than double the capacity of the viewing room. Wow. And this included many of his victims' relatives. He attempted to appeal his death sentence, of course, but on October 25th, 2006, 52-year-old Danny Rowling was executed by lethal injection. Before his death, Rowling met a journalist named Sandra London, and the two would go on to not only get engaged, but write a book together called The Making of a Serial Killer.
Stop.
You can buy this book today. It's on Amazon for $136.96, but I recommend not doing so.
If you buy that book, don't listen to our podcast anymore.
Yeah. One review of the book on Amazon is titled A Big Old Pity Party, and it sums it up perfectly. Basically, the book presents Danny as the victim. That's not the case. Don't get or read this book.
Yeah. I mean, as a child, he was a victim, but he went on to make decisions that made him the perpetrator and the victimizer.
So Rowling was executed in 2006, but back in 1994, after Rowling's conviction, that novice screenwriter Kevin Williamson saw that news program about the Gainesville Ripper and went on to write the script for Scream. On top of writing the screenplay for Scream, Scream 2, and Scream 4, I don't know what happened to 3. I don't know why he didn't write that one, but he also wrote the films I Know What You Did Last Summer, The Faculty, Cursed, and the 2022 film Sick. And he also created several TV series, including Dawson's Creek, The Vampire Diaries, The Following, and Tell Me a Story.
Those are all really good, except I've never seen Sick, is that what you said?
Sick, yeah.
Yeah, I've never seen that, but the rest of those are pretty solid.
Yeah, he became very, very famous.
Good for him, I guess.
While Danny Rowling is infamous for his murders and inspiring the classic Scream franchise, his victims' names are what is the important part of the story.
Yep.
Sonia, Christina, Krista, Manny, Tracy, Tom, Julie, and Sean lost their lives to a sadistic coward.
Mm-hmm.
They all seemed like they were incredible people who just had so much life ahead of them. And while they at least got justice, nothing will take away what happened to them.
Yeah.
Today, there are 5 trees planted to honor the Gainesville victims on the University of Florida campus, along with a mural that's along this big graffiti wall. And their names are on the wall in remembrance, and it has been untouched for 30 years.
Wow.
So while you watch horror films this spooky season, think of these victims. Rest in peace, Sonia, Christina, Krista, Manny, Tracy, Tom, Julie, and Sean. As difficult as the story was to hear, I wanted to tell it today because, as we've said before, the victims are the ones that are important here and they're just not discussed as much. Yeah. So if you do watch horror movies and you watch Scream this year, think of the victims, you know, give them a moment of your thought before watching the movie, because like I said, they're the important ones.
Yeah, that definitely gives it a new, I mean, I knew that the way after I watched it, I knew that it was loosely based on a true story, but I had no idea it was that like horrific and
yeah,
just terrible. So yeah, it definitely brings a new light to that movie for sure.
Yeah, definitely. But that's all I have for you guys today. Thank you so much for listening, as always. And until next time, keep it human.
Bye.